Welcome to Speaking in Maine on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, a public affairs program dedicated to bringing you speeches recorded from around the state, given by experts lecturing on topics from environmentalism and sustainability to the global economy, politics, and beyond. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today's program brings us to Rockland for a panel discussion sponsored by the Georges River Land Trust, titled Climate Change and Our Economy, a Positive Vision for Maine in an Era of Rapid Climate Change. The moderator and keynote speaker will be Unity College President Dr. Stephen Mulkey. Panelists include Natural Resources Council of Maine Executive Director Lisa Pullman, Maine Chapter of the Sierra Club Director Glenn Brand, and Revision Energy co-founder William Behrens. Dr. Mulkey will be introduced by Gail Presley, former Executive Director of the Georges River Land Trust.
So it's my great pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker tonight, Dr. Stephen Mulkey. He is the president of Unity College, an undergraduate institution known as America's Environmental College, with more than 650 undergraduates. Dr. Mulkey is a champion of sustainability science and has pivoted the curriculum at Unity College to focus on the what's next of environmentalism, sustainability science, and the transdisciplinary or collaborative approach to ecological problem solving. Among his many accomplishments, Dr. Mulkey divested the university's endowment of its holdings in the 200 largest fossil fuel companies and constructed new residence halls built to the LEED silver standards. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Stephen Mulkey.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It really is a pleasure to be here. I'm grateful for the opportunity to talk about what I think are the real challenges facing Maine right now. What I have is a hopeful vision for Maine. It may not sound like that initially, but please stay with me. I think there's real possibility here. Sir Nicholas Stern did a massive study of the economy worldwide of what it would be like if we didn't respond to climate change versus what it would be like if we did. And he made this statement. He said, climate change is the greatest market failure in history. Climate, in fact, is the greatest externality, and it's been completely left out of our economic approaches to humanity. Our present emissions trajectory is catastrophic. There's no question that that word applies. There are different emissions scenarios here that may play out. It's hard to predict which one will actually play out, but the trajectory that we're currently on actually exceeds the highest one. The global temperature rise by the end of the century will be more than 5 degrees centigrade, according to the UK Hadley Center, which is their equivalent of NOAA. And the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change fifth assessment in 2013 came up with a more conservative number, which is typical of the IPCC assessments. They're a consensus document, a little bit lower. The thing that we need to understand is either 5 degrees or 4.5 degrees, neither of those is consistent with civilization as it's currently configured. And so we need to avoid this if at all possible. The concentrations of CO2 are higher now than in 4 million years, and the CO2 rate of rise is faster than in 65 million years at least, and it may be the fastest ever recorded in paleohistory. So I'd like to focus on what I think is most germane to Maine in particular, and that's what I call this ecological imperative that's generally not being mentioned in the scenarios for managing climate change. This is how the climate zones are moving faster than many organisms, both plants and animals, can migrate or adapt. These are the zone shifts that occurred in this 15-year interval. Since then, the zone shifts have been even more pronounced. One of the things that's most important to know about this is that Maine has three climate zones that are compressed in only 4.5 degrees latitude because of a quirk of our geography, whereas the rest of the continent, they're spread over 21 degrees or more, and the same is true in Europe. They're spread over a much larger piece of real estate. The potential for rapid change is very high in Maine. And indeed, ecologists that are looking at Maine think they see exactly this. There are rapid changes that are underway. Now, if you have been following the Portland Press Herald special on the Gulf of Maine, you see that there's a lot of things to be concerned about. We heard about it just in this remarkable little animation. But it's also appearing last week in the journal Science, and a couple of weeks before that in the journal Nature. These are the hottest waters in the world during the winter at this point in time when this was looked at. If we look at what's actually happening off the coast of Maine and up around Greenland, we find this really cold spot. It's in fact the coldest water in the planet right now. And that's being driven by massive melt-off from the Greenland ice sheet. And that is in turn changing the dynamics of the Gulf Stream. And the Gulf Stream appears to be slowing. This is something that will happen on a millennial timescale. This is one of the many examples that we can point to of changes that will not reverse for 1,000 years. And in fact, right now, this cooling of the North Atlantic is unprecedented in over 1,000 years. It's a remarkable phenomenon. So here are some realities that I think we need to grapple with. First, we can burn only about 20% of the known conventional fossil fuel reserves if we are to keep warming below this putative guardrail of 2 degrees centigrade. Now, that guardrail is relatively arbitrary. And in fact, there's no doubt that some degree of dangerous climate disruption is unavoidable given the warming that's already in the pipeline. We've already seen that with Superstorm Sandy and a number of other extreme weather events. It's inappropriate to say that they're caused by climate change. The correct way to see those extreme weather events is that all weather is now occurring in a human-altered climate. So the real question to ask is, what features of those extreme events are related to climate change? And there are some very concrete answers to that. If you look at this first bullet point, you think that fossil fuel investments may become stranded assets, you're right. They will be if we are to grapple. So divestment was just smart economics, frankly. The other thing that we're seeing is that the pace of ecological change is accelerating. I'm an ecologist by training. I've been a member of the Ecological Society of America since 1973. And this is a heated topic of discussion in the society. Will Steffen, the Australian biologist, calls this the Great Acceleration. One thing to realize, and this is germane to Maine, is that habitats and species will be lost. Both local, regional, and global extinctions are going to ensue as a consequence of this. Many species will acclimate or migrate in ways that we currently can't predict. Many ecologists are projecting that we will have novel ecosystems that have never existed before, and I would submit to you that that is exactly what is happening in the Gulf of Maine right now. We're in the process of creating interactions among species that have never encountered each other before, and where is that ecosystem going to play out? We don't know. This leads me to two broad conclusions. Adaptation in our agriculture is absolutely essential, and we need to get ahead of the curve on this, especially in the small to intermediate scale agriculture in Maine. And civil engineering is imperative. If you have a road that crosses water 100 miles from the coast, because of the changes in storm surge is so amplified by sea level rise, that bridge needs to be looked at for re-engineering. It needs to be assessed up and down the eastern seaboard. Similarly, we have to train a generation to adapt through sophisticated management of complex natural and human systems that are interacting. It's that sophisticated management that I'd like to focus on, which I think can be the basis of a new economy for Maine. One of the hopeful tools that we have is a field that's called sustainability science. It's exactly what you think it is. It's education and research that seeks to understand the complexity of the interactions among economy, society, and nature to propose concrete solutions to problems that are threatening the very survival of humanity and certainly the survival of our civilization. So sustainability science, very simply, is knowledge for mitigation, avoiding emissions that otherwise would occur, or removing CO2 or greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. Adaptation, responding to the changes that are underway now and will continue throughout this century at least, and building resilience. Resilience is all about being able to maintain effective functioning in the face of a perturbation. The one thing we know about resilience that's been shown in the peer-reviewed literature repeatedly now is that the higher the diversity, the biological diversity, the more species that you have in a system, that tends to be the most resilient. This is endorsed by the U.S. National Academy of Science, the National Science Foundation, and the Association for the Advancement of Science. It's a powerful tool, and we frame the entire curriculum at Unity College under sustainability science. What we need are integrated adaptive management processes that include that red-haired stepchild of the sciences, social science. We need those guys at the table, and enterprise management. And when I say enterprise management, I mean in the sense that it's taught in business colleges. How many students graduate with a bachelor's degree and don't know how to organize and execute a project? These are essential tools, and stakeholder engagement, or the social primate, if you will, has to be right at the center of the adaptive management process. And one thing I'd like to point out that should be obvious, and that's that proactive adaptation is far less expensive and disruptive than is reactive adaptation. If we wait until these changes are upon us, we will rue that day. So I'm going to give a quiz at the end, and I want you to get all this down. Concept and system management. This is just a scattershot of all of the different interacting moving parts for the town of Port Orford as it grapples with the changes that are ensuing under climate change. This is a science, and it's an important tool going forward, and every municipality ought to be learning it. Another tool is scenario analysis. We often can't predict how things will play out under different drivers. So what we can do is come up with a range of scenarios, and as the trajectory of the future comes upon us and we see how things begin to play out, that points us to specific drivers which we can then manage. So this is a very powerful tool, but we have to figure out what those scenarios might be. My recommendation for Maine is very simple and perhaps hard to do. Create a knowledge economy focused on climate change adaptation. Folks, we are going to respond to the changes that are going to happen to our landscape and seascape. We will respond. Why don't we get ahead of the curve and configure an economy around that response? That's the point of what I have to say. The 20th century is gone. If you want to live in 1965, you're going to have to look for a different planet. That's probably not going to happen again. Resource abundance, business stability, well-defined industries, one-way markets, and sequestered information where there are only certain stakeholders that actually have the information. We're in a totally different world. We have resource constraints as we expand to 9 to possibly 12 billion souls by the end of this century. We have to value relationships. Two of the great authors of the American West, Stegman and Edward Abbey, have shown very clearly that in harsh environments, the only pathway forward for survival is sharing and collaboration. We've got to get better at that. Two-way markets, information abundance. For the first time in history, we live in an era where information is right at our fingertips, effectively all information. What we need to know is how to use it. So a knowledge economy is production based on knowledge-intensive activities, greater reliance on intellectual capabilities than raw materials or technology per se. And that's exactly what adaptation is. Unfortunately, I see a train wreck underway in Maine, and that's these two components that are colliding with one another over a series of decades. So this is a decadal time frame, if you will, up toward the middle of the century. So we have a failing economy driven by an upside-down demography. Fewer and fewer young people, many more elderly people and dependent people moving forward, and our transformation in natural resources driven by climate change. From where I sit, when I look at Maine, Maine is natural resources, full stop, period. It's forestry, fisheries, wildlife, freshwater, marine, that's what it is. And that's where we need to stand. We need to stand on that platform of natural resources to build an economy. So here's the demography of Maine. More and more of us, as we reach our mid-60s, and well, I'll include myself in that. Sorry, there's some young people in the audience, forgive me. And fewer and fewer under the age of 18. Maine's the oldest population in the nation. Median age of 42.7, and it has the highest old age dependency per 100 workers. So let's find a different future. We've got some advantages, some really important ones. First of all, there's abundant fresh water. The small farm, intermediate farm economy is the only sector of the Maine economy that's been reliably growing recently. Functional marine infrastructure, forests and large single owner parcels, which is both an advantage and a disadvantage. Abundant raw materials for biofuels that need to be sustainably configured. Land trust with established legal access for conservation of some form. There are over 90 land trusts in Maine. I would submit to you that that is too many, and that collaboration is absolutely essential. A system of higher education that is facing some extreme financial challenges right now, but has very good bones. It's a real opportunity to reconfigure higher education. Challenges: inverted demography, slow economic recovery, slower than the rest of the nation, cultural sectors that view in-migration as undesirable. Folks, people from away need to be welcomed with open arms. Inadequate and deteriorating infrastructure, bridges, roads, hydro, rapidly shifting climate zones and ecology, mistaken belief that impacts of climate change will not be severe and will be generally manageable without much change by us. So before I go to the adaptation possibilities, let's not forget the low-hanging fruit of mitigating greenhouse gas emissions by retrofitting the built environment. This is a huge part of the economy moving forward. It's a $16 trillion replacement value of all U.S. homes collectively, and the average Maine home costs $203,000 to replace. The retrofit of these homes for solar hot water, solar photovoltaic, geothermal in the right type of building, sustainable pellet heating, other forms of ground-sourced air heat, and passive house. This is our passive house residence hall, the first of its kind in the United States. It's a European design that manages the internal heat and conserves it. The first winter this house was open, we spent $83 to heat it. And the efficiency retrofits are manifold. There are dozens of such things, and all of these things result in jobs. I think Bill Behrens tonight will tell us some of the success that Revision Energy has had. But let's look at adaptation. So we've got sustainable and organic agriculture that's going big guns. We have young families drawn to Maine farms. They are getting hammered, folks. If you talk to these young farmers, they have a rough go. But they believe in what they're doing. They need tax incentives, low interest loans, debt relief. Viable niche and specialty markets exist within New England and in the Northeast Corridor that can be a market for these products. We need to develop a statewide national brand and get it out there. Build intermediate scale packaging and distribution facilities. This is a singular impediment to the kind of distribution to build those markets for those young farmers. And we need sophisticated knowledge to manage and adapt agriculture in the face of climate shifts. The UMaine system of extension is doing a lot. We need to do more. One of the things that's most exciting to me is that recent peer-reviewed literature is showing that agriculture properly configured can not only be done sustainably, but it can mitigate industrial emissions from automobiles and power plants. This CO2 sequestration that's done when properly configured can be immense. It could be a large way to play in the carbon markets. We know that managing biological impacts is absolutely an imperative. This is an older scenario that shows that New Hampshire, by the end of the century, under current emissions scenarios, will have a climate similar to that of southern Virginia or northern North Carolina. It's actually more extreme in the projection now. One of the things you see in the present day suitability of habitat for the forests of the eastern part of the U.S. is a great diversity of trees, especially the trees that we're really fond of up here in New England. But what we will see by the end of the century is suitability. There will be stands of what I call the living dead, trees that can no longer be viable in their particular location. But the suitability will be for that of oak, pine, and oak hickory. In my book, those trees belong in Missouri. And what I would suggest to you is that dynamic change management needs to begin now. If you know what kind of forest you want in the Northwoods of Maine, or in the Georges River Land Trust, in 2070, you must begin managing for that forest today, given the lifespan of trees. One of the tools, and this is a great shout out to the Georges River and the 12 Rivers Conservation Initiative, is their collaboration, their agreement to share personnel resources, financial resources, and understanding, and their observation that building corridors among these conserved areas is absolutely essential for the migration of plants and animals. Corridors will be the single most important tool for sustaining the natural biota of Maine moving forward. Who's creating the adaptation plans for our conserved lands? I think that's a really important question, and I don't have a good answer to it. So building the adaptation knowledge economy needs certain elements. Here are some of them. First of all, we need to understand the systems that must adapt. We have some great scholars and some great intellectual power in this state. We should be turning it toward this particular problem. We need to involve stakeholders right out of the gate, agencies, non-for-profit funders, nonprofits, and we need collaborative strategic planning among all institutions. That's long-range planning, especially among its institutions of higher education. Right now, most of our institutions of higher education operate in their own silo. We need to be bridging those silo walls. We should design for a network and collective infrastructure, not an organization. The days when you can run your own NGO and expect to be a major player and solve these problems are over. You must collaborate with others. Create multiple opportunities for connection and communication through that network, and remain flexible and committed to a decadal framework, a decadal vision of the future to make Maine the best place for developing, innovating, teaching, learning, and selling adaptation. So where's the money? Sell Maine's carbon resources as carbon offsets, participate in carbon markets. REGI is a big success. That's a success story in Maine, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. China is coming on gangbusters. We had a false start with the Chicago Climate Exchange. We will be playing in that market again, no question about it. Adaptation could be Maine's biggest service industry. Right now it's Hannaford's and healthcare. That makes me very uncomfortable. I think that our environmental services could be huge. They could be of great value to the state. We need to focus on adaptation, and higher education could bring millions from away. We need to begin to collaborate together to find the specialties that will allow the higher education institutions of Maine to make their own niche, to differentiate themselves from the others in the country. We need to export management innovations and knowledge. Every time we export a procedure or a process or a trademark process, that money comes back to the state of Maine. And we need to be building those concerns that can do that. So thank you. I want to say that the people that turn out for these things really do mean a lot to me. If you look at the science about what's happening on the Earth and you aren't pessimistic, you don't understand the data. But what I found is if you meet the people who are working to restore this Earth and you aren't optimistic, you haven't got a pulse. One of the things I know is that many of those people are in this room tonight, and it is a privilege to be with you. Thank you. We have with us this evening three people that I consider to be the leaders of the environmental issues in the state. Please hold your applause until I've read the bios of each, and we'll invite them up to the stage after that. Lisa Pullman, Dr. Pullman, is the Executive Director of the Natural Resources Council of Maine. NRCM is Maine's leading environmental advocacy organization. I've had the incredible privilege of serving on its board. And it's been working to address climate change for nearly 20 years. Lisa has led an advocacy organization throughout her 34-year career, has a PhD from the Muskie School of Public Service. She's a resident of Jefferson. Lisa has a lifelong love of the outdoors, and I assure you I've seen her in a kayak. She is terrific. Glenn Brand is the director of the Maine chapter of the Sierra Club. One of the people that I admire the most in the state. It's the oldest, one of the oldest and largest grassroots environmental organizations in the U.S. Glenn has served on the national staff of the Sierra Club for 12 years, serving on energy, climate, transportation, pollution, community organizing, and political issues at the national level. He's been quoted widely in the media, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, Boston Globe, and has given lectures on environmental issues around the U.S. and internationally. Dr. Behrens, Dr. Bill Behrens, is the co-founder and managing partner of Revision Energy, a Maine company engaged in the design, installation, and service of renewable energy systems, a real pioneer in Maine, primarily photovoltaic and solar thermal. In business since 2007, Revision Energy has two offices in Maine and two in New Hampshire. Bill was a co-founder, a co-owner of the Green Store in Belfast for 10 years. And one of the things I'd like to remind you of that many of you may not know is that earlier in his career, when Bill was at MIT, where he eventually took his PhD, Bill was a co-author of the classic science volume called The Limits to Growth. This is incredible, guys. I mean, I bet you didn't know this about him, and I'm really delighted to out him. He tries to keep this quiet, but The Limits to Growth is a classic. We use it to teach in most ecology and sustainability courses around the country, and Bill was one of the first authors working with Danella and Dennis Meadows. Thank you. Okay. Getting a little old. So please, welcome to the stage, Lisa, Dan, and Bill.
Well, hi, everyone. I'm going to talk really from the policy perspective in terms of how we're trying to address climate change from policy perspective. I'm going to talk a little about solar without stealing too much of Bill's thunder, a little about energy efficiency, a little about the Clean Power Plan, and I'm just going to touch lightly on natural gas because I know it's on your minds here in Rockland. So let me start with, who in the room has ever put in one of those curly CFL light bulbs or an LED? There we go. All right. Well, this is good because we have been working on energy efficiency first and foremost for over 20 years in Maine. NRCM was part of creating the legislation that created Efficiency Maine, and we work hard every year to make sure that it has the funding to do what it should be doing, which is provide grants and loans to homeowners, small businesses, and large industrial plants so that we can have the warmth and the lights that we need and the refrigeration, but making it more efficient and thereby using up less energy. We most recently, in 2013, as part of a large energy omnibus bill in the state legislature, directed the Public Utilities Commission to go after all cost-efficient energy efficiency. And most recently, if you were following legislative antics, you would have known that there was a clerical error, and last year we had a big legislative fight about the "and" that was left out of the writing of this particular bill. And the legislature unanimously said, no, 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 we meant that to be in, and they made sure it got back in. And so what is happening right now is Efficiency Maine is working on its three-year budget, trying to go after all cost-efficient, cost-effective energy efficiency. It needs its board to sign on to that, and then ultimately has to be passed by the Public Utilities Commission. That process will go on throughout the fall, and what we want is there to be as much energy efficiency funding as possible so that we can continue this process of making our old housing stock and our some of our very high energy intensive plants like Kutamaki, which I just visited recently in Waterville, and make small businesses as efficient as possible. So that's what we'll be doing. We always need folks to come to Augusta or call your legislator and say, we believe in this, it's important, and we should put as much money as possible into it. much like solar, it creates great jobs. You can't export those jobs to China because people need to be able to get in your attic, in your basement, and weatherize and put the foam in and all that kind of stuff, and that means jobs for Maine. So the next thing I'd like to just touch lightly on is solar. There are a lot of potential sources for energy. We think solar is the one we should be going at full board right now. And the first thing to know is any imagination that you have that Maine is a cold, dark state and not a good place for Maine is just flat out wrong. Not a good place for solar is flat out wrong. We have a great solar resource here as good as it is in Houston, Texas. And there's no reason in the world why we shouldn't be taking full advantage of it. The cost of solar is still a bit of a barrier, but the cost is coming down. And we are way behind our New England neighbors in taking up solar installations. If you even go to New Hampshire, and you know we hate to be behind New Hampshire, they've got more solar going on. All the states around us, Massachusetts is light years ahead, and that's because they've got good solar incentive policies, and we don't have anything. And so there's a stakeholder process that's working this fall, and our clean energy director, Dylan Voorhees, is right in the thick of it, working with the Solar Coalition, trying to make sure that there's a good set of policies that we can bring to the legislature and get passed. Because you know what? There's no reason in the world why Maine people can't be generating electricity on their roofs, in their backyards, as communities, that we can make it more affordable and make it more accessible. And it just makes so much sense. So enough on that, because I don't want to steal any more of Bill's thunder. I want to talk about the Clean Power Plan. So we've been waiting around for the federal government to do something about climate change for a long time. And finally, something is going to happen. We had good forward progress on auto efficiency, but now we have rules that are going to cap carbon emissions on power plants. Power plants are the number one largest source of carbon pollution, which creates climate change that there is. And as Dr. Mulkey mentioned, we have the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative in the Northeast. This is nine states who, all the way going back to 2007, we already decided, we understood this, and we have been capping carbon emissions and ratcheting it down, and we have been using the funding that's generated from that to fund our efficiency program here in Maine. The whole country should be doing this. And frankly, it would be so good because not only would it drive progress on climate change, but we would stop getting all of the mercury and other nasty stuff because we're at the end of the pipeline from all those coal-fired power plants in other states. So Obama's EPA came out with the Clean Power Plan in its final form in the summer. We are working to make sure that our senators, Senator King and Senator Collins, continue to support that plan because, guess what? Not every state is excited about this as we are in New England. West Virginia and Texas and other places are having a fit about it. Their senators are trying to derail it and defund it and stop it. And we need our senators, when those kinds of amendments and things come up, to just say, nope, we don't support that. This is good for New England. So that's something that we're working on. I just want to point out that we have some materials out in the hallway and we have a postcard. You never come to an event where NRCM is without getting asked to do something. So we are collecting these kinds of postcards to send to our senators, and that's one way that you can take an action. And finally, just a quick mention on natural gas, because I know there's a plant that might happen here. There's a lot of tension around natural gas. Here's the facts. The main fuel mix for our energy grid has improved for the better over many years. Oil was once 15 to 20% of the energy mix. Now we're down to about 1%. Coal was once 15 to 20%, now we're down to 5. Why has that happened? Well, it's been squeezed out by efficiency, squeezed out by wind, and squeezed out by natural gas. Carbon emissions have dropped because natural gas is a bigger part of the mix. It's not that they don't produce any carbon, but certainly not as much as coal or oil. The infrastructure being built for natural gas is going to be hard to shut off. It's hard to think about it as a bridge fuel when you know they're building pipelines and plants and things. And you know, it's like, well, this is a bridge fuel and you know, someday it'll all be solar and wind. Well, yeah, it's going to be hard to shut those things off. That's just a fact. right now, low oil prices are making it hard for natural gas to expand because folks are like, well, you know, oil's not that expensive. I'm not going to pay to switch out my oil furnace. And that's why you see a lot of big ads from Summit Energy right now, you know, looking for new customers. I believe that the price of natural gas will inevitably go up with demand around the globe. So that's just kind of the facts of it. Energy sources are on a continuum. There's no such thing as a free lunch with any of them. There are the really bad ones, the less bad ones, the less bad ones, until you get to something like solar, which I think is really good. So go ahead.
Thank you, Lisa. Well, good evening. Can you hear me on this? It's a little hard to tell.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. Well, it's a pleasure to be invited to speak before you all tonight and to follow Stephen and Lisa. They both talked about the kinds of solutions that we need, and we could add more, and we could discuss some of those, but I'm not going to do that in my time. What I want to talk about is how we're going to implement these solutions. Right, so we have these policy solutions, but how do we get there? The Sierra Club, as most of you probably know, has been doing grassroots organizing, and I think we invented grassroots organizing. 1892 is when the club started, and we really are committed to grassroots organizing and activism as the essential driver of change. And history shows that all successful movements were the result of grassroots organizing, not just on climate, but everything. That's what builds the social movements and political power that creates the conditions to make the change that we're looking for. You know, I think of this, it's one of my favorite Lincoln quotes, but I think of this when, you probably know the quote, Lincoln wrote, "Public sentiment is everything. With public sentiment, nothing can fail. Without it, nothing can succeed." We really lack that public sentiment to bring about the kinds of change that we need, particularly in the time period that we have to do it. So the question is, how do we build that public sentiment? And of course, you know what I think. It's through grassroots local organizing. The challenges of organizing on climate are enormous. So I think we need to be really honest. You know, why is it harder to organize on climate than other issues? So number one, there's the scale of the problem. There's the complexity of it, right? An enormous worldwide energy system that's taken a long time to develop. And then there's the urgency of the problem. We don't have a lot of time to deal with it. Another issue is that the future impacts are much worse than short-term impacts. So we need to have people acting now in advance of the worst, and that's challenging. There are, of course, the enormous powerful self-interests that are opposing action, you know, the Exxons of the world, et cetera, and really entrenched ideological opponents to making change. There's a healthy but complicated tension between individual action, us changing our light bulbs, and then what we really need are large systemic actions, right? So we need both of those, but that is intention. We can't just do one or the other. And then more recently, we have a terrible dysfunction in our politics, both in the Capitol in D.C. and here in Augusta. So it seems to the Sierra Club that if we're going to address climate disruption in time to minimize the impacts in the short term, and more importantly, to avoid the worst impacts for future generations, the ones that Stephen outlined, we're going to need to achieve two really big goals. The first one is an orderly transition away from dirty fossil fuels to 100% clean energy. And we need to do that by mid-century. We have about a generation to do it if we're going to follow the science that Stephen talked about. Not 80% clean energy, 100% clean energy. So that's a huge lift. And we're going to do that in a lot of ways, in a lot of the ways that Lisa talked about, energy efficiency and clean energy investment. The other piece, and Stephen mentioned this, is we're going to have to leave most of the remaining fossil fuels in the ground. And, you know, when I say this to some audiences, they just don't register what I'm saying. But, you know, I would note that this week's news of the Keystone Pipeline falling apart was the result of people making just that argument, that we need to leave the dirtiest of fuels in the ground. And I think also the success of the Maine tar sands pipeline fight is evidence of that people are beginning to come around on this idea as a concept. Sierra Club believes that, you know, while we have the responsibility to pose dirty energy policies and projects, we really must focus more of our attention, if not most of our attention, on implementing the positive clean energy solutions. So it's important that we say yes to things and not just no to things. On the state level, Sierra Club Maine strategic vehicle to generate and galvanize grassroots progress is our Maine Climate Action Team program, which had its roots in the historic People's Climate March of last year in New York City. Just a show of hands, did anyone attend that march? Yes, quite a few people, that's right. Did anyone ride one of our charter buses? Can't see. We organized 6 charter buses to bring Maine climate activists to the big march in New York City, which was attended by an estimated 400,000 people. I was there, and I've never seen a crowd like that, and I've been in a lot of big crowds. And for those of you who attended the march, or if you saw it on TV or online, you know that it was tremendously inspiring and energizing. You know, people came back from the march really, as Obama would say, fired up and ready to go. Unfortunately, the results of the 2014 national and state elections just 5 weeks after the march were really disheartening to a lot of us and really diminished the chances of large-scale climate action in the short term. Our response has been to create our local climate action teams, or short, we use the acronym CAT program. And that's a structure to support and encourage local activists to implement meaningful local clean energy solutions in their towns and to help spread those solutions across the state. You know, we launched our Climate Action Team program just late last year, December, at a conference at Bowdoin. And we featured breakout sessions on a range of local solutions like community solar farms, town energy efficiency outreach programs, fighting dirty energy infrastructure projects, public transportation, compost recycling programs, local grassroots organizing, and more, with the ideas to replicate these solutions elsewhere. We are now looking forward to our second Climate Action Team conference on December 12th at the University of Maine in Augusta. And I invite everyone here to attend. Go to our website, sierraclub.org/Maine, to register for the conference and to find out how you can join or start your own climate action team where you live. Right now, there are 9 active climate action teams, or CATs, throughout Maine. And I'll give you an example of what they're working on, so at least just so you get an idea. In Freeport and in Portland, the CATs have already developed 2 community solar farms and are in the process of developing 2 more. The CAT in Kennebunk is working to get the municipal utility to build a utility-scale solar project. That would be the first in the state if it happens, and I'm confident that it will. The CAT in Brunswick has introduced a plastic bag fee program, which seems to be catching on around the state. The Fitchburg CAT is partnering with Habitat for Humanity on an energy efficiency outreach program. The Wiscasset CAT is advocating for rooftop solar arrays on town buildings. And you get the idea. To accomplish these goals, the Climate Action Team members are engaging their neighbors, and that's the only way this happens. They're educating and empowering the public and local public officials. Again, the truth is that with the LePage administration in power for the next 3 years, Maine will, I wrote sigh. I'm joking. Maine will likely not make substantive progress on climate and clean energy issues. We may make some progress, but we're not going to make substantive. But we obviously can't afford to play only defense until the next election, and who knows what happens then, right? So we believe that local grassroots action is the key. It not only improves our local communities, right? When you have a solar array, that's going to help your community. You have a better energy, you can more easily help your neighbor tighten up their home, you improve your community. But I think getting back to Lincoln's quote, you know, it creates the demand, the public support, the public sentiment for larger scale climate solutions, both here in Maine and throughout the country. Thank you.
So, Stephen, thank you for the nice intro. Sorry you had to mention that as an undergraduate, I contributed to a book. Actually, that piece of my lifetime was a really seminal and important one, and it's, in a way, really nice to be sort of almost full circle back to it. Lisa and Glenn, both of you, I think, are true agents of social change, and that, for me, is really what this is all about, that we're all trying to create the future that we want our children and grandchildren to grow up in. That's what we're engaged in doing. We all do it in different ways. I happen to do it by trying to put up as many solar panels as possible, as quickly as possible, because I think that's a way of creating the future that is sustainable and is actually the one that is going to be more pleasant to live in than the future that is being left to us by the entrenched interests of the past 150 years. But basically what we're doing is making social change happen. And at Revision, for example, we speak of ourselves as a company of social change. We know that every day we go out, we send 30 trucks out every day to put up solar panels, but it's almost more important the interaction between the guy on the roof and the homeowner than it is that we got those solar panels on the roof. The long-term effect of the solar panels is huge, but the long-term effect of creating another vibrant and vocal member of this group of people who are creating the future we want to create is also huge. So we're delighted that in the past, since January, Revision has hired 42 additional people. Revision now has 115, roughly, employees, where in 2003 we had two. Now that's the kind of that's the kind of future economy that Stephen is talking about that we can create in the state of Maine. We have a brilliant collection of natural resources up here. We also have a brilliant collection of people up here, and we need to get that message out to the rest of the world. I'm delighted that Unity College is well on its way to creating it for itself a reputation of national scope, and this inviting and welcoming bright young people to the state of Maine. And I'm glad that there are employment opportunities here in the state of Maine so that they stay here. I personally think we ought to be going to job fairs at University of Colorado and University of Santa Barbara and attracting other excited, interested, forward-looking young people to the state of Maine, because after all, we have a lifestyle here that is one of the most attractive in the country, and why we aren't creating our economy based on clean energy, clean technology, is beyond me. I think, yes, we have a great history of our traditional industries, and I am not about to walk away from our traditional industries, but we also have a very bright future in non-traditional, forward-looking, clean energy industries that I think have a role in the state of Maine and can reverse that unfortunate aging process, that unfortunate demographic of being the oldest state in the country. I think we can reverse that, and it wouldn't take that much. I mean, Maine has an identification nationwide that, as Stephen says, ought to be extended to our food products, ought to be extended to our knowledge products, our colleges, ought to be extended to our industries, so that we continue to be identified nationally as the place to be. Just as much as Boulder is the place to be, I think Unity, Maine should identify itself as the place to be. Rockland, Maine. All of you probably live in this area. Can you believe how nice it is to live in Rockland, Maine? It's phenomenal. It's absolutely phenomenal. And that's because people have been working here to create a viable and vibrant future for decades. And it's starting to show up. It's actually starting to show up. All of the energy and effort that's been going into creating this social change that at times has felt pretty far distant and unattainable is starting to be attained. And we see it in the solar industry that the social change process always follows an initial period where it just feels like a total uphill struggle. And then finally you get past an inflection point and it starts to feel a whole lot easier. Solar has reached that inflection point. It's only done it in the past couple of years, by the way, in the New England region. It did it a few years earlier in some other regions that had viable state policies. But in New England, it's reached that inflection point. And now the financial resources are coming into that industry. It's regarded as an industry that is financially viable. Big money flows in. We have big money failures in solar now, which is pretty unique. I mean, solar used to be an industry that was so tiny that you would never have a big money failure because there was no big money in it. Now we have big money failures. You know, SolarCity's stock price has dropped by 75% over the past 3 months. That's kind of exciting, actually. It's a big enough industry that you can lose money in it. But really what's going on is there's a social change happening and we can't, it's going to be hard to stop. And the more all of us as agents of that social change can just keep kicking that wheel forward, that's what all of us need to do. And we can actually take a little bit of pride that we've gotten it to this point and a little bit of joy and feel a little bit of optimism that we've gotten it to this point. And actually, it's going to be easier going forward than it has been in the past. And the acceptance of land trust, for example, I remember sitting on the board of a tiny little land trust at the upper reaches of the Georges River zone about 10 years ago. And there were actually battles about whether this land trust should exist or not in the community. It's like people in the community thought land trusts were, you know, some scary foreign influence and needed to be run out of town. We used to do Common Ground Fair back in the early 90s, and people, 90% of the people who came to the booth would say, can solar energy work in Maine? I mean, isn't it like too cold and too dark here? All of that has shifted. We don't have maybe 2% of the people ask that question of us now at the Common Ground Fair. That's a huge change in the environment of acceptance for what we're all passionate about creating, which is a future, not just energy, but also lifestyle, agriculture, education, interaction, community. That future is the one we want to create, and it's starting to get a little bit easier to create it. 43 years ago, when we wrote Limits, and I was an undergraduate at MIT, and we would have to stand up in front of the American Bankers Association. And climate change, the words climate change didn't even exist in the vocabulary at that point. We were simply talking about the inevitable conflict between an ever-expanding population, ever-expanding consumption of natural resources, ever-expanding release of pollution. That's a conflict that is destined to have a consequence that we need to think about. And we get a bunch of nodding heads in the audience. 1,000 bankers would sit there, and then as soon as the talk was over, straight to the bar. Boy, that was interesting. Let's have a drink. Not a single banker ever went home and thought about climate change or sustainability or the energy future. It's different now. It's very different now. We have made progress. There's still a lot of work left to be done, but I hope you find it easier from now on. I hope you find that there's actually some momentum, there's actually some buy-in, and yep, we've got some obstacles. Yep, we've got a lot of state houses that are trying to be co-opted by ALEC and trying to be co-opted by the oil industry. But I have the hope and actually now the feeling that they're going to be unsuccessful, that we are going to win and we are going to create the future that we want to create. And we are going to do it in time. So I'll leave you with that piece of optimism and hope.
You've been listening to a panel discussion titled Climate Change and Our Economy, A Positive Vision for Maine in an Era of Rapid Climate Change, here on Speaking in Maine. The talk was sponsored by the Georges River Land Trust, a nonprofit conservation group that aims to protect land and natural resources. More information at georgesriver.org. Time restraints have forced us to cut the lengthy and informative question and answer section of the program. You can, however, find the full version on our website, mpbn.net. Look under the On Demand tab for audio on demand. Charles Beck is our executive producer. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Gordon Fellis.